This is audible.
Søren Kierkegaard. Fear and Trembling. A dialectical lyric by Johannes de Silencio. Read by Mark Meadows for Naxos Audiobooks. What Tarquin the Proud communicated in his garden with the beheaded poppies was understood by the sun, but not by the messenger. Haman. Preface. Not only in the commercial world, but in the realm of ideas as well, our age is holding a veritable clearance sale. Everything is had so dirt cheap that it is doubtful whether in the end anyone will bid. Every speculative scorekeeper who conscientiously keeps account of the momentous march of modern philosophy, every lecturer, tutor, student, every outsider and insider in philosophy does not stop at doubting everything but goes further. Perhaps it would be inappropriate and untimely to ask them where they are actually going, but it is surely polite and modest to take it for granted that they have doubted everything, since otherwise it would certainly be peculiar to say that they went further. All of them, then, have made this preliminary movement, and presumably so easily that they do not find it necessary to drop a hint about how, for not even the one who anxiously and worriedly sought a little enlightenment found so much as an instructive tip or a little dietary prescription on how to conduct oneself under this enormous task. But Descartes has done it, hasn't he? Descartes, a venerable, humble, honest thinker, whose writings surely no one can read without the deepest emotion, has done what he has said and said what he has done. Alas, 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 that is a great rarity in our age. As he himself reiterates often enough, Descartes did not doubt with respect to faith. At the same time, we should remember, as noted earlier, that the natural light is to be trusted only to the extent that it is compatible with divine revelation. But above all else, we must impress on our memory the overriding rule that whatever God has revealed to us must be accepted as more certain than anything else. And although the light of reason may, with the utmost clarity and evidence, appear to suggest something different, we must still put our entire faith in divine authority rather than in our own judgment. Principles of Philosophy 1, Section 28 and Section 76. Descartes has not yet yelled fire and made it a duty for everyone to doubt, for he was a quiet, solitary thinker, not a bellowing street watchman. He has modestly confessed that his method had importance only for himself, and was based partly on his earlier distorted knowledge. My present aim, then, is not to teach the method which everyone must follow in order to direct his reason correctly, but only to reveal how I have tried to direct my own. But as soon as I had completed the course of study, at the end of which one is normally admitted to the ranks of the learned, I completely changed my opinion. For I found myself beset by so many doubts and errors that I came to think I had gained nothing from my attempts to become educated, but increasing recognition of my ignorance. Discourse on Method, pages 2 and 3. What those ancient Greeks, who also surely understood a little about philosophy, assumed to be a task for a whole lifetime, because proficiency in doubting is not achieved in a matter of days and weeks, what was achieved by the old veteran polemicist, who had preserved the equilibrium of doubt through all specious arguments, bravely denied certainty of the senses and of thought, and incorruptibly defied the anxiety of self-love and the innuendos of sympathy, with that, everyone in our age begins. In our age, nobody stops at faith, but goes further. To ask where they are going would perhaps be foolhardy. However, it is surely a sign of courtesy and good breeding for me to assume that everyone has faith, since otherwise it would be peculiar to talk of going further. In those olden days, it was different. Then, faith was a lifelong task, because it was assumed that proficiency in believing is not achieved in either days or weeks. When the tried and tested oldster drew near to his end, having fought the good fight and kept the faith, his heart was still young enough not to have forgotten that fear and trembling which disciplined the youth and was well controlled by the man, but is not entirely outgrown by any person, except insofar as one succeeds in going further as soon as possible. Where those venerable figures arrived, there everyone in our age begins in order to go further. The present writer is not at all a philosopher. He has not understood the system, whether it exists or whether it is finished. He already has enough for his weak head in the thought of what huge heads everyone in our age must have, since everyone has such huge thoughts. Even if one were able to convert the whole content of faith into conceptual form, it does not follow that one has comprehended faith, comprehended how one entered into it, or how it entered into one. The present writer is not at all a philosopher. He is, poetically and tastefully expressed, a freelancer who neither writes the system nor makes promises about the system, who neither swears by the system nor pledges himself to the system. He writes because for him it is a luxury that becomes all the more enjoyable and conspicuous the fewer who buy and read what he writes. He easily foresees his fate in an age when passion has been abandoned in order to serve scholarship, in an age when an author who wants readers must take care to write in such a way that his work can be conveniently skimmed through during the after-dinner nap, and take care to fashion his outer appearance in likeness to that polite garden apprentice in The Advertiser, who, with hat in hand and good references from the place where he was last employed, recommends himself to an esteemed public. He foresees his fate of being totally ignored. He has a frightful presentiment that zealous criticism will put him through the mill many times. He dreads what is even more frightful, that one or another enterprising summariser, a paragraph gobbler, who in order to save scholarship is always willing to do to the writings of others what Trupp magnanimously did with The Destruction of the Human Race in order to save good taste, will cut him up into paragraphs and do it with the same inflexibility as the man who, in service to the system of punctuation, divided his discourse by counting the words so that there were exactly 50 words to a period and 35 to a semicolon. I prostrate myself in deepest deference before every systematic snooper. This is not the system. It does not have the least thing to do with the system. I invoke all the best upon the system and upon the Danish investors in this omnibus, for it is not likely to become a tower. I wish them one and all good luck and prosperity. Respectfully, Johannes de Silencio. Tuning up. There was once a man who, as a child, had heard that beautiful story about how God tested Abraham, and how he withstood the test, kept the faith, and received a son a second time, contrary to expectation. When the man became older, he read the same story with even greater admiration, for life had separated what had been united in the child's pious simplicity. Indeed, the older he became, the more often his thoughts turned to that story. His enthusiasm became stronger and stronger, and yet he could understand the story less and less. Finally, he forgot everything else because of it. His soul had only one wish, to see Abraham, one longing, to have been a witness to that event. His desire was not to see the beautiful regions of the Far East, not the earthly splendor of the Promised Land, not that God-fearing married couple whose old age God had blessed, not the venerable figure of the aged patriarch, not the vigorous youth of Isaac bestowed by God. It would not have mattered to him if the same thing had taken place on a barren heath. His longing was to accompany them on the three-day journey when Abraham rode with sorrow before him and Isaac by his side. His wish was to be present at the hour when Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw Mount Moriah in the distance. The hour he left the asses behind and went up the mountain alone with Isaac. For what engrossed him was not the artistic weave of the imagination, but the shudder of the thought. That man was not a thinker. He felt no need to go beyond faith. It seemed to him that it must be the greatest glory to be remembered as its father, and an enviable lot to possess faith, even if no one knew it. That man was not a learned exegete. He did not know Hebrew. Had he known Hebrew, then perhaps he would easily have understood the story and Abraham. 1. And God tested Abraham and said to him, "Take Isaac, your only son, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering upon a mountain that I will show you." It was an early morning. Abraham rose early, had the asses saddled, and left his tent, taking Isaac with him. But Sarah looked out the window after them as they went down through the valley, until she could see them no more. They rode silently for 3 days. On the morning of the fourth day, Abraham still did not say a word, but lifted up his eyes and saw Mount Moriah in the distance. He left the servant boys behind and went up to the mountain alone, leading Isaac by the hand. But Abraham said to himself, "I will not conceal from Isaac where this path is taking him." He stood still and laid his hand upon Isaac's head for a blessing, and Isaac bowed to receive it. And Abraham's countenance was paternal, his gaze was gentle, his speech exhortatory. But Isaac could not understand him. His soul could not be uplifted. He embraced Abraham's knees. He pleaded at his feet. He begged for his young life, for his fair hopes. He recalled the joy in Abraham's house. He recalled the sorrow and the solitude. Then Abraham raised the boy up and walked along holding his hand, and his words were full of comfort and exhortation. But Isaac could not understand him. He climbed Mount Moriah, but Isaac understood him not. Then he turned away from Isaac a moment, but when Isaac saw Abraham's countenance again, it was changed. His eyes were wild, his appearance a fright to behold. He seized Isaac by the chest, threw him to the ground, and said, "Foolish boy, do you believe that I am your father? I am an idolater. Do you believe this is God's command? No, it is my desire." Then Isaac trembled and cried out in his anguish, "God in heaven, have mercy on me. God of Abraham, have mercy on me. If I have no father on earth, then you be my father." But Abraham murmured under his breath to himself, "Lord in heaven, I thank you. It is surely better for him to believe I am a monster than to lose faith in you." When the child is to be weaned, the mother blackens her breast, for it would indeed be a shame for the breast to look delightful when the child must not have it. So the child believes that the breast has changed, but the mother is the same, her gaze is loving and tender as always. Fortunate the one who did not need more frightful measures to wean the child. 2. It was an early morning. Abraham rose early. He embraced Sarah, the bride of his old age, and Sarah kissed Isaac, who took away her disgrace, who was her pride, her hope for all generations. Then they rode silently along the way, and Abraham's eyes were fastened upon the ground until the fourth day, when he lifted up his eyes and saw Mount Moriah far away, but his eyes turned again towards the ground. Silently he arranged the firewood and bound Isaac. Silently he drew the knife. Then he saw the ram that God had chosen. He sacrificed it and went home. From that day on, Abraham became old. He could not forget that God had demanded this of him. Isaac flourished as before, but Abraham's eyes were darkened. He saw joy no more. When the child has grown larger and is to be weaned, the mother covers her breast in a maidenly manner, so the child no longer has a mother. Fortunate the child who did not lose its mother in some other way. 3. It was an early morning. Abraham rose early. He kissed Sarah, the young mother, and Sarah kissed Isaac, her delight, her joy at all times. And Abraham rode pensively along the way. He thought of Hagar and the son whom he turned out into the desert. He climbed Mount Moriah. He drew the knife. It was a quiet evening when Abraham rode out alone, and he rode to Mount Moriah. He threw himself upon his face. He begged God to forgive his sin, that he had been willing to sacrifice Isaac, that the father had forgotten his duty toward the son. More than once he rode his lonely trail, but found no peace of mind. He could not comprehend that it was a sin to have been willing to sacrifice to God the best he owned, that for which he himself would gladly have laid down his life many times. And if it were a sin, if he had not loved Isaac in this way, then he could not understand how it could be forgiven. For what sin was more grievous? When the child is to be weaned, the mother, too, is not without sorrow that she and the child are more and more to be parted, that the child who first lay beneath her heart, yet later reposed upon her breast, will not be so close any more. Thus, together, they mourn this brief sorrow. Fortunate the one who kept the child so close and did not need to sorrow more. 4. It was an early morning. Everything was ready for the journey in Abraham's house. He took leave of Sarah, and the faithful servant Eliezer saw him out along the road until he turned back again. They rode together in harmony, Abraham and Isaac, until they came to Mount Moriah. Yet Abraham calmly and gently prepared everything for the sacrifice. But as he turned away and drew the knife, Isaac saw that Abraham's left hand was clenched in despair, that a shudder went through his body. But Abraham drew the knife. Then they returned home again, and Sarah hurried to meet them. But Isaac had lost the faith. Never a word is spoken about this in the world. Isaac never spoke to any person about what he had seen, and Abraham did not suspect that anyone had seen it. When the child is to be weaned, the mother has more solid food on hand, so the child will not perish. Fortunate the one who has this stronger nourishment handy. In these and many similar ways, that man of whom we speak pondered over this event. Every time he returned home from a pilgrimage to Mount Moriah, he collapsed from fatigue, clasped his hands, and said, "Surely no one was as great as Abraham. Who is able to understand him?" A tribute to Abraham. If there were no eternal consciousness in a human being, if underlying everything there were only a wild, fermenting force writhing in dark passions that produced everything great and insignificant, if a bottomless, insatiable emptiness lurked beneath everything, what would life be then but despair? If such were the case, if there were no sacred bond that tied humankind together, if one generation after another rose like leaves in the forest, if one generation succeeded another like the singing of the birds in the forest, if the human race passed through the world as a ship through the sea, as the wind through the desert, a thoughtless and futile activity, if an eternal oblivion always hungrily lay in wait for its prey, and there were no power strong enough to snatch it away, then how empty and hopeless life would be. But that is why it is not so. And as God created man and woman, so he fashioned the hero and the poet or orator, The latter can do nothing that the former does. He can only admire, love, and rejoice in the hero. Yet he too is happy, no less than the former, for the hero is, so to speak, his better nature with which he is infatuated, yet delighted that it is, after all, not himself, that his love can be admiration. He is the guardian spirit of recollection. He can do nothing without remembering what has been done, do nothing without admiring what has been done. He takes nothing for himself, but is protective of what is entrusted to him. He follows his heart's desire, but when he has found what was sought, he wanders about to every man's door with his song and speech, so that everyone may admire the hero as he does, be proud of the hero as he is. This is his achievement, his humble task, his faithful service in the house of the hero. If he remains true to his love in this way, if he struggles day and night with the cunning of oblivion which wants to trick him out of the hero, then he has fulfilled his task. He is united with the hero, who has loved him just as faithfully, for the poet is, so to speak, the hero's better nature, feeble like a memory, to be sure, but also glorified like a memory. Therefore, no one who was great will be forgotten. And even if it takes a long time, even if a cloud of misunderstanding whisks the hero away, his lover still comes, and the more time goes by, the more steadfastly he clings to him. No. No one who was great in the world will be forgotten. But each was great in his own way, and each in proportion to the greatness of what he loved. For the one who loved himself became great by himself, and the one who loved other persons became great by his devotion. But the one who loved God became greater than everybody. Each will be remembered, but each became great in proportion to his expectation. One became great by expecting the possible, another by expecting the eternal. But the one who expected the impossible became greater than everybody. Each will be remembered, but each was great wholly in proportion to the magnitude of that with which he struggled. For the one who struggled with the world became great by conquering the world, and the one who struggled with himself became greater by conquering himself, but the one who struggled with God became greater than everybody. Thus there was conflict in the world, man against man, one against a thousand, but the one who struggled with God was greater than everybody. Thus there was conflict on the earth. There was the one who conquered all by his power, and the one who conquered God by his powerlessness. There was the one who relied on himself and gained everything, and the one who, secure in his own strength, sacrificed everything. But the one who believed in God was greater than everybody. There was the one who was great by his power, and the one who was great by his wisdom, and the one who was great by his hope, and the one who was great by his love. But Abraham was greater than everybody. Great by that power whose strength is powerlessness. Great by that wisdom whose secret is folly. Great by that hope whose form is madness, great by that love which is hatred of oneself. By faith, Abraham emigrated from the land of his fathers and became a foreigner in the promised land. He left one thing behind and took one thing with him. He left his worldly understanding behind and took faith with him. Otherwise, he undoubtedly would not have emigrated, but surely would have thought it preposterous. By faith, he was a stranger in the promised land, and there was nothing that reminded him of what was dear to him, but his soul was tempted to wistful nostalgia by the novelty of everything. And yet he was God's chosen one, in whom the Lord was well pleased. In fact, had he been a castaway banished from God's grace, he could have understood it better. But now it certainly seemed like a mockery of him and his faith. There was also in the world one who lived in exile from the ancestral land which he loved. He is not forgotten, nor are his songs of lamentation when in sadness he sought and found what was lost. From Abraham there is no song of lament. It is human to lament, human to weep with the one who weeps, but it is greater to believe, more blessed to behold the believer. By faith, Abraham received the promise that in his seed all the generations of the world would be blessed. Time passed. The possibility was there, Abraham believed. Time passed. It became preposterous, Abraham believed. There was one in the world who also had an expectation. Time passed. Evening drew near. He was not wretched enough to have forgotten his expectation. Therefore, neither will he be forgotten. Then he sorrowed, and the sorrow did not cheat him as life had done. It did everything it could for him. In the sweetness of sorrow, he possessed his disappointed expectation. It is human to sorrow. It is human to sorrow with the sorrowing one, but it is greater to believe, more blessed to behold the believer. From Abraham, we have no song of sorrow. He did not mournfully count the days while time passed. He did not look at Sarah with suspicious eyes as to whether she had not become old. He did not halt the movement of the sun so that Sarah would not grow old and with her his expectation. He did not soothingly sing for Sarah his mournful melody. Abraham became old. Sarah became the object of ridicule in the land, and yet he was God's chosen one, and heir to the promise that in his seed all the generations of the earth would be blessed. So would it not have been better, after all, if he were not God's chosen one? What does it mean to be God's chosen one? Is it to be denied one's youthful wish in youth, so that it may be fulfilled with great pains in old age? But Abraham believed, and held on to the promise. If Abraham had wavered, then he would have given it up. He would have said to God, "Well, perhaps it is not your will after all that it should happen, so I will give up the wish. It was my only wish, my blessedness. My soul is sincere. I harbor no hidden resentment because you denied it." He would not have been forgotten. He would have saved many by his example, but still would not have become the father of faith. For it is great to give up one's wish, but it is greater to keep a firm grip on it after having given it up. It is great to lay hold of the eternal, but it is greater to stick doggedly to the temporal after having given it up. Then came the fullness of time. If Abraham had not believed, Sarah might well have died from sorrow, and Abraham, dulled by grief, would not have understood the fulfillment, but only smiled at it as at a youthful dream. But Abraham believed. Therefore he was young, for the one who always hopes for the best grows old, cheated by life, and the one who is always prepared for the worst grows old prematurely. But the one who believes preserves an eternal youth. So let us pay tribute to that story. For Sarah, though aged, was young enough to crave the pleasure of motherhood, and Abraham, though grey-haired, was young enough to wish to be a father. Outwardly, the wonder is that it happened in accordance with their expectation. In a deeper sense, the wonder of faith consists in Abraham and Sarah being young enough to wish, and in faith's having preserved their wish and with it their youth. He accepted the fulfillment of the promise. He accepted it in faith, and it happened according to the promise and according to faith. For Moses struck the rock with his staff, but he did not believe. So there was rejoicing in Abraham's house when Sarah stood as a bride on their golden wedding anniversary. But it was not to remain that way. Abraham was to be tried once more. He had fought with that ingenious power which invents everything, with that vigilant enemy which never dozes, with that old man who outlives everything. He had fought with time and kept the faith. Now all the frightfulness of the struggle became concentrated in one moment. And God tested Abraham and said to him, "Take Isaac, your only son, whom you love. Go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering upon a mountain that I will show you." Thus everything was lost, which is even more frightful than if it had never happened. So the Lord was only mocking Abraham. Miraculously, he made the preposterous come true. Now he would see it brought to nothing again. It was indeed folly, but Abraham did not laugh at it as Sarah had done when the promise was first proclaimed. Everything was lost. 70 years of faithful expectation, the brief joy over faith's fulfillment. Who is it, then, that snatches the staff from the old man? Who is it that demands he himself must break it? Who is it that makes a man's grey hairs disconsolate? Who is it that demands he himself must do it? Is there no compassion for this venerable old man? None for the innocent child? And yet Abraham was God's chosen one, and it was the Lord who put him to the test. Now everything would be lost. The glorious remembrance of posterity, the promise in Abraham's seed, was only a whim, a passing thought of the Lord's, which Abraham now must obliterate. That glorious treasure, which was just as old as the faith in Abraham's heart, and many, many years older than Isaac, the fruit of Abraham's life, dedicated by prayer, ripened in combat. The blessing on Abraham's lips, this fruit, would now be plucked prematurely and be without meaning. For what meaning would it have if Isaac must be sacrificed? That sad but still blessed hour, when Abraham would take leave of everything that was dear to him, when he would once again lift up his venerable head, when his countenance would become radiant like the Lord's, when he would concentrate his whole soul in a blessing that was mighty enough to make Isaac blessed all his days, that hour would not come. For Abraham would indeed take leave of Isaac, but in such a way that he himself would remain behind. Death would separate them, but in such a way that Isaac would become its prey. The old man would not joyfully at death lay his hand upon Isaac in blessing, but weary of life would lay a violent hand upon Isaac. And it was God who tested him. Yes, woe! Woe to the messenger who brought such news to Abraham! Who would have dared to be the emissary of such sorrow? But it was God who tested Abraham. But Abraham believed, and believed for this life. To be sure, had his faith been only for a future life, he could indeed more easily have cast everything away in order to hurry out of the world to which he did not belong. But Abraham's faith was not like that, if there be such a faith, for that is not really faith, but only the remotest possibility of faith, which faintly spies its object at the edge of the horizon, yet is separated from it by a yawning abyss within which despair plays its tricks. But Abraham believed precisely for this life, that he would grow old in the land, honoured by the people, blessed by posterity, forever remembered in Isaac, his dearest one in life, whom he embraced with a love for which it would be only a poor expression to say that he faithfully fulfilled a father's duty to love the son, as indeed it goes in the summons, "The son whom you love." Jacob had 12 sons, one of whom he loved. Abraham had only one son, whom he loved. But Abraham believed and did not doubt. He believed the preposterous. If Abraham had doubted, then he would have done something different, something great and glorious, For how could Abraham do anything else but what is great and glorious? He would have set out for Mount Moriah, he would have chopped the firewood, lit the fire, drawn the knife, he would have cried out to God, "Do not disdain this sacrifice, it is not the best I have, that I know very well, for what is an old man compared with the child of promise? But it is the best I can give you. Let Isaac never come to know it, that he may take comfort in his youth." He would have thrust the knife into his own breast. He would have been admired in the world, and his name would not be forgotten. But it is one thing to be admired, another to become a guiding star that rescues the anguished. But Abraham believed. He asked nothing for himself in an attempt to move the Lord. It was only when the just penalty against Sodom and Gomorrah was issued that Abraham came forward with his appeals. We read in those sacred scriptures, "And God tested Abraham and said, 'Abraham, Abraham, where are you?' But Abraham answered, 'Here am I.'" You to whom my speech is addressed, was that the case with you? When far away you saw hard times approaching, did you not say to the mountains, "Cover me," and to the hills, "Fall on me"? Or if you were stronger, did not your feet still drag along the way, longing, as it were, to be back on the old paths? When a call came to you, did you answer or not, perhaps softly and in a whisper? Not so Abraham. Cheerfully, confidently, trustingly, he answered in a loud voice, "Here am I." We read further, "And Abraham rose early in the morning." He hurried as if going to a celebration, and early in the morning he was at the appointed place on Mount Moriah. He said nothing to Sarah, nothing to Eliezer. Indeed, who could have understood him? Did not the test by its very nature require a pledge of silence from him? He chopped the firewood, he bound Isaac, he lit the fire, he drew the knife. My listener, many a father has thought himself deprived of every hope for the future in losing his child, which to him was the most beloved in the world. Yet surely none was a child of promise in the sense that Isaac was for Abraham. Many a father has lost his child, but then it was God, the unchanging and inscrutable will of the Almighty, whose hand took it. Not so with Abraham. A harder test was in store for him, and Isaac's fate, along with the knife, lay in Abraham's hand. And he stood there, the old man with his only hope. But he did not doubt. He did not look anxiously to the right or to the left. He did not challenge heaven with his appeals. He knew it was God the Almighty who tested him. He knew it was the hardest sacrifice that could be demanded of him. But he also knew that no sacrifice was too hard when God demanded it. And he drew the knife. Who strengthened Abraham's arm? Who held up his right arm so that it did not limply collapse? Anyone who looks upon this scene becomes paralyzed. Who strengthened Abraham's soul, lest everything went black before his eyes, so he could see neither Isaac nor the ram? Anyone who looks upon this scene goes blind. And yet, while it is perhaps rare enough that anyone becomes paralyzed and blind, still more rarely does anyone worthily tell what happened there. We all know it. It was only a test. If Abraham had doubted when he stood on Mount Moriah, if he had looked about in indecision, if by chance he had spotted the ram before drawing the knife, if God had permitted him to sacrifice it instead of Isaac, then he would have gone home. Everything would have been the same. He would have had Sarah. He would have kept Isaac. And yet, how changed! For his descent would have been an escape, his deliverance an accident, his reward disgrace, his future perhaps perdition. Then he would have testified neither to his faith nor to God's grace, but to how frightful it is to go up to Mount Moriah. Then Abraham would not be forgotten, nor Mount Moriah. Yet it would not be mentioned like Ararat, where the ark landed, but spoken of as a place of dismay, because it was here that Abraham doubted. Venerable Father Abraham, when you went home from Mount Moriah, you needed no tribute to console you for what was lost, for you indeed gained everything and kept Isaac. Was it not so? The Lord never again took him from you, but you sat happily at dinner with him in your tent, as you do in the next world forever. Venerable Father Abraham, thousands of years have elapsed since those days, but you need no latter-day lover who can snatch your memory from the power of oblivion, for every language commemorates you. And yet you reward your lover more gloriously than anyone. In the world to come, you make him blissfully happy in your bosom. Here you captivate his eyes and heart by the wonder of your deed. Venerable Father Abraham, second father of the human race, you who first felt and testified to that prodigious passion which disdains the frightful battle with the raging elements and the forces of creation in order to struggle with God, you who first knew that supreme passion, the holy, pure, and humble expression for the divine madness admired by the pagans, forgive the one who would speak in praise of you if he did not do it properly. He spoke humbly, as was his heart's desire. He spoke briefly, as is becoming, but he will never forget that you needed 100 years to get a son of your old age, contrary to expectation, that you had to draw the knife before you kept Isaac. He will never forget that in 130 years you got no further than faith. Problems. A preliminary outpouring from the heart. An old adage drawn from the external and visible world says, "Only the one who works gets the bread." Oddly enough, the adage does not apply in the world where it is most at home, for the external world is subject to the law of imperfection, and here it happens again and again that the one who does not work also gets the bread, and the one who sleeps gets it more abundantly than the one who works. In the external world, everything belongs to the possessor. It toils slavishly under the law of indifference, and the genie of the ring obeys whoever has the ring, whether he is a Nur-ed-Din or an Aladdin. And whoever has the world's treasures has them, no matter how he got them. In the world of spirit, it is otherwise. Here an eternal divine order prevails. Here it does not rain on both the just and the unjust. Here the sun does not shine on both good and evil. Here it holds true that only the one who works gets the bread. Only the one who was in anxiety finds rest. Only the one who descends into the underworld rescues the beloved. Only the one who draws the knife gets Isaac. The one who will not work does not get the bread, but is deceived, just as the gods deceived Orpheus with an airy apparition instead of the beloved, deceived him because he was sentimental, not courageous, deceived him because he was a lute player, not a man. Here it does not help to have Abraham for a father, nor 17 noble ancestors. What was written about the maidens of Israel applies to the one who will not work. He brings forth wind, but the one who is willing to work gives birth to his own father. There is a form of knowledge that presumptuously wants to introduce into the world of spirit the same law of indifference under which the external world sighs. It thinks it is enough to know the great. Other work is not needed. But that is why it gets no bread. It perishes from hunger, while everything is transmuted into gold. And what does it really know? There were many thousands of Greek contemporaries, and countless numbers in later generations, who knew all the triumphs of Miltiades, but there was only one who became sleepless over them. There were countless generations who knew the story of Abraham word for word by heart, but how many did it make sleepless? Now the story of Abraham has the extraordinary quality of always being glorious, no matter how poorly it is understood. But here again, it is a matter of whether one is willing to labour and be heavy laden. But one does not want to work and yet wants to understand the story. One speaks in Abraham's honour, but how? By presenting the whole story in quite ordinary terms. The great thing was that he loved God so much that he was willing to sacrifice the best to him. That is very true, but the best is a vague term. In the course of thinking and jabbering away, one quite confidently identifies Isaac and the best, and the meditator can very well smoke his pipe while cogitating, and the listener can very well stretch out his legs comfortably. If that rich young man whom Christ met on his way had sold all his possessions and given the money to the poor, we would then praise him as we do everything that is great, and would not even understand him without working. But he still would not have become an Abraham, even though he sacrificed the best. What is left out of Abraham's story is the anxiety. For to money I have no ethical obligation, but to the son, the father has the highest and most sacred duty. Yet anxiety is a dangerous subject for the delicate-natured. Therefore one forgets it, in spite of the fact that one wants to talk about Abraham. One speaks, then, and in the course of orating, interchanges the two terms Isaac and the best, and everything goes splendidly. However, if it so happened that among the listeners there was a man who suffered from insomnia, then the most frightful, the most profound, tragic, and comic misunderstanding lies very close. He went home, he would do just like Abraham, for the son is, after all, the best. If that speaker heard of it, he perhaps went to the man, gathered all his clerical dignity, and shouted, "You detestable person, you pariah of society, what devil has so possessed you that you want to murder your son?" And the parson, who had not felt any warmth or perspiration while preaching on Abraham, would be surprised at himself, at the earnest wrath with which he fulminated against that poor man. He would be pleased with himself, for never had he spoken with such force and fervour. He would say to himself and his wife, "I am an orator. What was lacking has been the occasion. When I spoke about Abraham last Sunday, I did not feel moved at all." If this same speaker had a modest excess of understanding to spare, then I think he would have lost it if the sinner calmly and in a dignified manner had replied, "After all, that was what you yourself preached on last Sunday." How could the parson even get such an idea into his head? And yet it was certainly so, and the mistake was simply that he had not known what he was saying. Yet there is no poet who could bring himself to prefer situations like this to the stuff and nonsense that fills comedies and novels. The comic and the tragic touch each other here in absolute infinity. In itself, the parson's discourse was perhaps ludicrous enough, but became infinitely ludicrous by its effect. And yet this was quite natural. Or suppose the sinner, without making any objection, actually became converted by the parson's castigation. Suppose this zealous clergyman went cheerfully home, elated in the consciousness that he was effective not only from the pulpit, but above all with his irresistible power as a spiritual adviser, inasmuch as he inspired the congregation on Sundays, while on Mondays he stood like a cherub with flaming sword before the one who by his action would put to shame the old saying that things do not happen in the world as the parson preaches. However, If the sinner was not convinced, then his situation is indeed tragic. He would probably be executed or sent to the madhouse. In short, he would become unhappy in relation to so-called actuality, although in another sense I certainly think that Abraham made him happy, for the one who works does not perish. How does one explain such a contradiction as that speaker's? Is it because Abraham has a prescriptive right to be a great man, so that whatever he does is great, and when another person does the same thing, it is a sin, a flagrant sin? In that case, I do not wish to be party to such thoughtless tribute. If faith cannot make it a holy act to be willing to murder one's son, then let the same judgment be passed upon Abraham as upon everybody else. If one perhaps lacks courage to think one's thought through to say that Abraham was a murderer, then it would certainly be better to acquire that courage than to waste time on undeserved tributes. The ethical expression for what Abraham did is that he intended to murder Isaac. The religious expression is that he intended to sacrifice Isaac. But in this contradiction lies precisely the anxiety that indeed can make a person sleepless, and yet Abraham is not who he is without this anxiety. Or perhaps Abraham did not do what is narrated there at all. Perhaps due to circumstances of the time it was something entirely different. Then let us forget him. For what is worthwhile in remembering the past that cannot become a present? Or perhaps that speaker had forgotten something corresponding to the ethical oversight that Isaac was the son. For if faith is taken away by becoming null and void, all that remains is the brutal fact that Abraham intended to murder Isaac, which is easy enough for anyone to imitate who does not have faith, that is, the faith that makes it difficult for him. Personally, I do not lack the courage to think a thought whole. So far I have feared none, and should I encounter one like that, then I hope at least to have the honesty to say I am afraid of this thought. It stirs up something strange in me, and therefore I will not think it. If I do wrong by that, then punishment certainly will not fail to come. If I had acknowledged as true the judgment that Abraham was a murderer, I do not know whether I could have silenced my reverence for him. However, if I had thought that, then I would probably have kept silent about it, for one should not initiate others into such thoughts. But Abraham is no illusion. He has not slept his way to renown. He did not owe it to a caprice of fortune. Can one then speak candidly about Abraham without running the risk that an individual in mental confusion might go and do likewise? If I dare not, then I will keep absolutely silent about Abraham, and above all, I will not scale him down in such a way that precisely by that he becomes a snare for the weak. For if one makes faith everything, that is, makes it what it is, then I certainly think one may dare speak about it without risk in our age, which is scarcely extravagant in faith, and it is only by faith that one acquires a resemblance to Abraham, not by murder. If one makes love into a fleeting sentiment, a sensual feeling in a person, then one only sets traps for the weak in wanting to talk about the exploits of love. Certainly everyone has passing emotions, but if, as a result, everyone wanted to perform the frightful act that love has sanctified as an immortal feat, then everything is lost, both the exploit and the one gone astray. It is no doubt permissible, then, to speak about Abraham, for the great can never do harm when construed in its greatness. It is like a double-edged sword that kills and saves. If the lot fell on me to speak about him, I would begin by showing what a devout and God-fearing man Abraham was, worthy to be called God's chosen one. Only someone like that is put to such a test, but who is such a person? Next, I would describe how Abraham loved Isaac. To that end, I would bid all good spirits to stand by me so that my speech would be as glowing as paternal love. I hope to describe it in such a way that not many a father in the king's realms and lands would dare to claim that he loved in this way. But if he did not love as Abraham loved, then any thought of sacrificing Isaac would surely be a temptation. One could already talk about this for several Sundays. Certainly there is no need to hurry. If it were told properly, the result would be that some fathers would by no means insist on hearing more, but for the time being would be pleased if they actually succeeded in loving as Abraham loved. If there were then one who, after having heard about the greatness, but also about the frightfulness of Abraham's deed, ventured to proceed upon that trail, I would saddle my horse and ride with him. At every stop, before coming to Mount Moriah, I would explain to him that he could still turn back, could repent the misunderstanding that he was called to be tried in such a conflict, could acknowledge that he lacked courage, so that God himself must take Isaac if he wanted to have him. It is my conviction that such a person is not repudiated, that he can become blessed along with everyone else, but not in time. Would not such a person be judged in this way, even in the times of greatest faith? I knew a person who on one occasion could have saved my life if he had been magnanimous. He said plainly, "I see well enough what I could do, but I dare not do it. I am afraid that later I will lack strength and regret it." He was not magnanimous, but who for that reason would not continue to love him? Having spoken thus and stirred the audience so they were really sensible of the dialectical struggles of faith and its gigantic passion, then I would not be guilty of an error on the part of the audience should they think, "Well now, he has faith to such a high degree, it is already enough for us just to hold on to his coattails." For I would add, by no means do I have faith. I am by nature a clever fellow, and such persons always have great difficulties in making the movement of faith, except that I certainly do not attribute in itself any worth to the difficulty which brought the clever fellow no further by overcoming it than to the point where the simplest and most innocent person arrives more easily. Love surely has its priests in the poets, and one occasionally hears a voice that knows how to honour it, but on faith not a word is heard. Who speaks in honour of this passion? Philosophy goes further. Theology sits by the window all made up and courts its favour, offering to sell its delights to philosophy. It is said to be difficult to understand Hegel, but to understand Abraham is a small matter. To go beyond Hegel is a miracle, but to manage Abraham is the easiest thing of all. I, for one, have devoted considerable time to understanding the Hegelian philosophy. I believe also that I have understood it fairly well, and I am foolhardy enough to think that when I cannot understand him in certain passages, in spite of the effort applied, then probably he himself has not been entirely clear. All this I do easily, naturally, without getting a headache from it. However, when I must think about Abraham, I am virtually annihilated. At every moment I am aware of that prodigious paradox which is the content of Abraham's life. At every moment I am repelled, and in spite of all its passion, my thought cannot penetrate it, cannot make a hair's breadth of headway. I strain every muscle to get a perspective, and at the same instant I become paralyzed. I am not unacquainted with what has been admired as great and magnanimous in the world. My soul feels an affinity with it, and in all humility is convinced that it was my cause too for which the hero struggled, and in a moment of meditation I cry out to myself, "Now your interest is at stake." I think myself into the hero. I cannot think myself into Abraham. When I reach that height, I fall down, since what is offered to me is a paradox, Yet by no means do I therefore think that faith is something lowly, but on the contrary, that it is the highest. Plus, that it is dishonest of philosophy to proffer